Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Royal Automobile Club talk show. We are recording this podcast just before the club's annual motoring dinner, and we are delighted to welcome the star of the evening, Roger Penske.
Well, a pleasure for me to be here to do this podcast, and it's an honor to be able to join the festivities tonight at the Royal Automobile Club. It's a very special place.
Well, we are delighted to have you, and tonight's dinner will celebrate your illustrious career in motorsport and mark 50 years since you first entered the Indianapolis 500. For those of you watching this on the motorsport website or the Royal Automobile Club website, you're going to the dinner, and that's why we are all dressed in formal attire this evening.
Correct.
As Roger mentioned, I'm Joe Dunn, editor of Motorsport Magazine. I'm joined by Samarth Kanal, who's our star reporter on the magazine. And together we're going to try and cover as much of Roger's incredible career and a lifetime's involvement in motorsport as we can. First as a driver, then as a team owner and a businessman. I'd like to start maybe just by mentioning to the listeners what we just spoke about and your hectic itinerary. You landed a few hours ago, and you'd been in a party last night, and I gather you're then flying off tomorrow morning somewhere else.
Well, I think it was a busy day yesterday. I was in Phoenix, Arizona last night for our winner's circle. This is where we crown our best operators and salespeople in our truck leasing business. As you know, in the U.S., we have over 300,000 trucks in our fleet, so these are pretty special people that make all that happen. So I left, got here about 4:30, and I'll leave early in the morning to a trip to Germany. So it's a whirlwind tour, but a very, very exciting time for me tonight.
Fantastic. So there's so much ground to cover. I'd like to start by talking about the Indy 500. Not the first race that you took part in 69, which we are celebrating tonight, but the first experience of the race a few years before that. I believe in 1951, your dad took you to the race. I just wonder whether you could tell us what your memories of that experience were.
Well, that was pretty special as a young man, 14 years old, and your dad say, "How would you like to go to the Indy 500?" I'd listen to it on the radio. Obviously, I was already bitten by a car bug, so to go there, and we didn't have very good seats. We could hardly see the cars on the track in those days, old wood grandstands. But Lee Wallard won that race, and I guess that I was infected, by Indianapolis, that weekend, and certainly that race. And I went to every single race except the 4 years when IRL, the Indy Racing League, and USAC, we got into some differences, so we stayed out of that race. But, when you think about it, 46 years, we've been competing there and have 17 wins. It's a magnificent, magic place.
And I mean, what is the magic of the race? And for a UK listening audience, how would you kind of explain the romance of the Indy 500?
Well, I think it started out as a month's journey when you went there and you practiced and you qualified and then on into the race. But it's the greatest automobile sporting event in the world. I think that, they'll have over 300,000 people there this year. It's an amazing oval, 2.5 miles, and it brings the greatest drivers. I don't think there's a Formula One driver, an IndyCar, NASCAR, anyone around the world that wouldn't like to have his face on that BorgWarner Trophy with Graham Hill, Jackie Stewart. Think about some of the people, Jack Brabham, that have raced there and been successful. So to me, we've built our brand with that. And as I tell people, and I'll say this tonight, I think there are three major things in your business and in your racing career that you look at. And one is building a brand, and I think the Indianapolis 500 has certainly built our brand. We operate in five countries. It's amazing when you think about that. But it set the brand value for us. The technology, you think about, we had stopwatches. We had to look at a car to find out how fast we went to online. Today you can see every driver, every move certainly the technology growth, and then the people. You see, racing and building that Indy team for me was so important. I think that's the common thread through our businesses.
And that was that year with the US 500. when you boycotted Indy, and take me through why Indy was boycotted and why Team Penske decided to run in the alternative race.
Well, I think that it was USAC at that particular time. It was the sanctioning body, and we had differences on how we wanted to run IndyCar. They had these other series. They had stock cars. They had midgets. They had championship cars, and there wasn't the focus. And we just couldn't get together them as a car owner group. So obviously, probably not a good idea as I reflect back today, but we left the series, but came back, obviously, in 2001 had victories there almost to hit three in a row. So I look back, not a very good idea, but I've moved on from that probably four-year hiatus.
You mentioned some of the great drivers. Obviously, Mark Donohue is someone that all of our readers and listeners here remember. I mean, can you talk us a bit about those early years and your relationship with him and your partnership with him? Presumably, it was you against, I mean, it must have felt very much like it was you against the rest of the world.
Well, I think that, you know, Mark was an engineer from Brown University up in the Northeast. I saw him racing in sports cars, quite honestly, at Lime Rock Park. And a friend of mine said, you got to watch this guy. Well, we got together and formed, you know, a team. It was like a brother. And, you know, we started to build, you know, Penske Racing at that day. It's now Team Penske. But, you know, we got together, and our goal was obviously to go to Indianapolis. And I was fortunate to have a sponsor, Sunoco, an oil company in Philadelphia. And I guess we went to Indianapolis. Our first year was seven people. And we go back in 2019, we'll have almost 700 years of experience in our garage.
Mark Donohue was an immensely busy man. It's hard to imagine nowadays how busy he was, because in 1971, for example, he raced in Grand Prix. He took an it was a World Championship podium at Mosport. He was racing in USAC races. I mean, it's hard to count. I have two hands. I can't count how many races he did. And he had a very in-depth knowledge of the cars because of his engineering degree.
Well, his engineering background was a real asset to us. Maybe it was an unfair advantage, as we called it in those days. But we were competing in road racing. We were competing in some NASCAR, the International Race of Champions, Formula One. So there was lots of things that we were involved in. But, you know, Mark was the guy that swept the floor at night. He drove the truck if he had to, and he worked on the cars. And I think that common thread of a flat organization and a personal commitment is really the foundation to our company today, some 66,000 people, and certainly our race team.
And he was synonymous with the Penske name, of course. You said he drove the trucks. How did he come to doing that? I mean, did you ask him to, or did he jump?
Well,
jump
we were in? Many nights we would work all night long. The mechanics, when we had to get off to a race, and he would sleep and get up and drive the truck to the track. So, you know, that's the kind of guy he was. I mean, he was all in. He was passionate about motor racing. He wanted to be a winner. And he also wanted to set a standard, a different standard maybe than what we had seen in the past.
And what's interesting to me as well is you said the unfair advantage before, one of the ones that always astounds me is in the Trans Am series when you dipped your Camaro in acid. Now, how did you come to that idea? I always wonder how you invent such a trick to save weight.
Well, it was interesting. You got a body in white, which was basically a unibody type construction. And we found an acid tank in California where we could dip the chassis in and it would take 50, 60, 70 pounds off. Well, the first couple times when they pulled it out, it was kind of like a sock. But then we got the right ingredients and we picked up probably 50 to 60 pounds of weight. And then, of course, the roof had a lot of oil can in it. So we put a cover on the roof, as you would call a leather cover, which you had on many cars at that time, and kind of had perforations on it so they couldn't see the oil can. We told them we put that on there because it made the car faster like a golf ball. So we had some fun with that. Probably the most interesting unfair advantage is when we built a 30-foot fueling rig and put the 55-gallon drum or whatever, 30 gallons on top of it. And we could fuel in about 3 seconds, and everybody else was taking 8 or 9 or 10 seconds. So that lasts for about two races, and they said, tear it down and take it home.
Speaking of unfair advantage, I think maybe one of the first ones was the Zerix Special, which I understand is being rebuilt at the moment.
Well, the Zerix Special, you know, had an interesting history. It was an Indy car that was driven at the Watkins Glen Grand Prix, I think by Walt Hansken, if I'm not sure, and it was damaged. It was a Cooper. I bought that car, and then Jack Brabham came to Indy with a 2.7 liter Cosworth. So we put the Cosworth engine in the Formula One chassis, and then we had a young man in Philadelphia. We built a body, and I sat in the center, and of course won the Riverside race, won the Laguna Seca race with it. And of course then the people said, well, you can't sit in the center. I said, what about the 2 liter Coopers today that are running? They didn't care. They said, change it. So we changed it. And we still won with that vehicle many times. And then that ended up being the vehicle that Bruce McLaren put a Buick engine, a V6 Buick, which started McLaren. So Bruce and I were great friends because of the Cooper relationship. But a very interesting car and fast. And I remember bringing it over to running it at Bank Holiday in August. And I remember we had Dunlop had black tires, and the green spots were the ones you ran in the rain. I was able to run those in the dry, and I remember one that day, and the scrutineering people were all over us. But I remember Graham Hill came over and helped get me through inspection after the race. So pretty exciting times.
How amazing that that car should have a seed really for Bruce McLaren's subsequent empire, and obviously you started off in it. I want to jump forward slightly to your Formula One years, and could you tell me sort of why you got involved and also whether you feel that you should have stayed a bit longer?
Well, as you know, we bought Graham McRae's shop down in Poole, I think, in 1973-74. Our first PC1 Formula One car was designed by Jeff Ferris, as you probably know. And it was really a start. We were looking at Formula One. We ran a season. John Watson then became our driver. We won the Austin Grand Prix. You know, obviously, Mark, we had a tragic accident with Mark Donahue in Austria years before. And amazing that, you know, what we were able to gain. But the thing was that it was a cottage industry here in the UK, you know, with Formula One, people from New Zealand and Great Britain and Australia. It was just seemed to me the technology was here. We didn't really have it in the U.S. And this chance to move into this country, and because of my relationship racing Coopers and Monaco and those things, I had a real good feel. So I made the investment. We had some very good people, Heinz Hofer, and then Derek Walker, and really Nick Guzet is the one that really gave us the real bandwidth to build the company. But Formula One was something that was important. But as we started to get to Indianapolis and see the success we could have with Penske-built cars, even though they came from the UK, you know, it was really amazing. And, you know, with IROC and NASCAR and all the things we were doing, we felt from a business perspective, and B2B is very important to me, with the racing being the common thread, we would then continue in the U.S. And, you know, I guess it was so at 76, we finished fifth in the championship. And I think we're the only American team since we won in Austria back in 76, I think you probably know the numbers better than I do, that's won a race. So I feel pretty good about that.
Yeah. Well, you're still the only American team to have won a race, as you say.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Something that strikes me as a team owner is that you can have an emotional connection with your drivers. And when Mark Donahue lost his life that day at the Austrian Grand Prix in practice, how hard was it to keep everyone's spirits up and stop, you know, heads dropping? And what was the general feeling in the paddock? I assume it wasn't great, but yeah.
Well, I was not there that day personally, but, you know, obviously the impact to me personally, as I said, he was like a brother. He was the heart and soul of the team for so many years. It was a big decision. What do we do? But I knew that Mark, as he would be in his way, said, keep going. And that's what we did. And to me, his family and the racing family around him was a tragic loss. But you know, to me, we moved on, and unfortunately that event, you know, still is up here, because he was really the catalyst, you know, and that cornerstone of our success early on.
And just days before, he set the fastest racing lap ever at Talladega in the 917, right?
And yeah, the 917-30, we were sponsored, by Sun Oil Company, and Cam 2 was a brand. So the goal was to set the world closed course record, which we did at Talladega. We were hoping that car didn't fly out of the track because, as you know, it's a very fast track.
And, I mean, so it was a sponsor-driven event that Mark eagerly must have jumped into the car thinking that he could set the fastest lap. Is that something that you always talked about, or was you guys always wanted?
Well, we felt from a B2B, from a sponsor perspective, it would be great to have that record, and we knew the car was fast. We never really opened it up because, you know, it was a beast, I think, when you think about how fast it was. But no, we decided to do it. Fingers crossed. I was there that day, and you know, Mark was at his best, and no problems. We got the speed record, loaded it up, and went home.
Did he drive the truck or?
No, I didn't drive, and he didn't drive it that day. We were probably had a beer after that. I'm not sure what we did.
As you say, you left Formula One in 1976. Have you ever been tempted to return in all the years?
Well, we've looked at it, and you know, I know Gene Haas because of the racing relationship that we have in NASCAR. I think that as I saw Formula One and the commitment as it scaled up and the cost and the people, I was just not going to be able to run my business, operate in the U.S. in the race, and try to compete with the teams that you have over here, which, you know, the factory teams, and at that at particular time. So I think that the cost levels are significant, and we would not get the benefit of the notoriety and the brand building from Formula One that we do in the U.S., to be honest with you. So I think there was a little bit of a business thought. Was overload, and it really was where we thought we could be successful, really made us say, let's just stay the course in the U.S. But, you know, when the rules change, sometimes it'll draw new people in, and I think that I'm not sure the state of the sport today. I don't know what's really going on. You only know what you read, so I'm assuming it's accurate. But I miss it. I'd love to be competing there, and I'd love to come with American team, with American drivers, but I'm not sure at my age that's the next chapter.
Well, you never know. I mean, Liberty Media have made a big play of wanting to expand the sport in the U.S. If its exposure if it became more popular, would you consider?
I don't. You have to run the whole city. You'd love to run a race with your people, but we just wouldn't be competitive. You know, the technology and the teamwork and the drivers. I mean, it's just, you can see Alonso's come over and run some races in the U.S. and just see how good these drivers are. And in the rain, he was absolutely fantastic at Daytona. But I think that's not on the shelf right now.
Sorry, no, it was just going back to not viewing yourself as a competitive force in F1. But when you first dropped into the Daytona 24 Hours, for example, I think you won the GT class that year in 1966.
Right.
Did you not feel that maybe we're not going to be competitive here? How did you view the competition that year? I mean, it can't be easy just stepping in.
Well, that was interesting. As I talked about Sun Oil before, they were our sponsor. And Elmer Bradley was the head of sales and marketing. And he bought a Corvette from me at the dealership one night, and I talked him into, let's go to Daytona with a Corvette. It was red. We had a Sunoco decal on it and $250. So it was somewhat of a, I wanted to go and see what it was all about. We had a sponsor. And that point, obviously, was the one that launched us, you know, through our Indy wins, our Can-Am wins, and things like that all became that first meeting or night with Mr. Bradley. But you never know. But that was, remember, I was a lot younger in those days, so... And probably had a lot more didn't have the understanding of the sport that I do today, maybe.
I want to come sort of right up to date, really, and talk about your 2018 season. Great season, probably one of your best.
Well, when you think about 2018, we won 32 races. Two of them were at Daytona and the weeks before the big race, 35 poles. We led over almost 5,400 laps in all the series, and the Indy 500 obviously is a crown jewel. We let Will Power down during the season. We had a couple of failures. You know, one, he was on the pole in both cases, one at Elkhart and one in Portland, and we had a gearbox go out on the pace lap and an engine, which really cost him potentially the championship. But winning the Indy race and six other races in total, you know, really was a crown that we obviously would look for at Indy. Then you go to NASCAR and you think about you know, the challenge you have there running 38 races. And, you know, we really prepared at the end of that season, and we got Joey in the chase. They take 16 drivers. It comes down to four at the very end. And it's ironic that of the last 12 races in the series, you know, we won six. So we really were on our game at that point. And then to square off at Daytona with four drivers, one who finishes ahead of the other wins the championship. And we not only won the championship, but won the race. And I think that was a crowning achievement for us, because we won it in 12. We're the only team that's won it twice between 2012 and 2018. Now, people don't really look at that stat, but to me, as competitive as it is, I think it's an amazing time. And then going on to think about Down Under, the Supercar Series. I'm not sure how many people follow that here in the UK, but it's a great series. It's road racing. We run, I think, 17 weekends and run two different Saturday Sunday races, and certainly Scotty McLaughlin is one of the great drivers we've ever had on our team. He delivers. We're racing against three Holdens every weekend, and he and Fabian Coulthard, and it was a crowning. In fact, in a 2-week period, we had no championships, either NASCAR or the Supercar, or we had two. And as it ended up, it was a fantastic season for our team. You know, we have about 500 people on our team on a worldwide basis. And just think of the human capital. When we talk to people about it, 25% of our people today have worked for us for more than 10 years. So when you think about continuity in your business, drivers staying with the team, the engineering, and think about some of the great teams here in Formula One, you see that continuity, the ones that continue to lead and win. So I think we just have a great bunch of guys.
What struck me about the NASCAR season especially is something that I paid a lot of attention to is when Joey Logano won. He seemed to have a big rivalry with Joe Gibbs Racing's drivers, and I always thought there was a lot of animosity between the two. Do you ever get involved in the feuds that he has? You know, especially when they come over into the pit lane and square off. Do you ever get involved? Or,
well, you know, let me just take you back. We were looking for a driver to drive with Brad Keselowski, and Brad mentioned that Joey, and I'd watched Joey. He'd won a number of Xfinity races, that we call it today, and I felt that he would be a great driver. We contacted him. He was very interested, and Gibbs didn't have a full-time ride with him in the Cup Series. They did in the second series, the Under Series. So I called Joe, and he said, give me a week, because we're trying to put something together. Well, obviously, in 5 or 6 days, he didn't get that done. So he came over with us. We didn't poach him. We were really very transparent. And I think that he was like the last guy out over there. You know, they had these drivers, you know, Kyle Busch and the team they had there, and they were really interested in this young kid that came along. But he came on with us, and he got himself, you know, he's a charger. And he got himself in a couple issues there, and he was kind of painted with a black hat on for a number of years. So there was some certainly animosity. But, you know, Joey, off the racetrack, you think about it, the night before the race in Homestead, he and his wife went to a Publix market and handed out 100 turkeys to homeless people. So that's the soft side of this young man. But the real side is to see him race on the racetrack. And he's going to be a leader, and he'll be a champion again, I'm sure, many times. But, you know, you have these rivalries, you know, off the track we're friends. It's like Formula One. On the track, it's dog eat dog. So to me, I think that it's really never spilled over. And I know Joey well, and I back him, good or for whatever it is. He's my driver. He works for us. We work together, and we back him.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
And you mentioned Joey Logano. I mean, how good is he as a driver, and what do you think makes him so special?
Well, I think that he's got a lot of experience. You know, he's in his mid-20s. Think about that. And he's been in NASCAR for, 8 or 9 years. And I think that that experience, I think that he wants to be a winner. He knows how to win. He's obviously done that. And to me, that he works so well with a team. And, you know, we have a world-class company in Shell as our sponsor, and he is connected with them on a business basis as a real marketing partner. And with that, he's grown from a commercial perspective, because you got to have a good driver, they got to be able to communicate technically, then they also have to have this commercial brain also that says, how do we promote the product? And it's not just outside, but it's inside Shell Oil. It's a big worldwide organization. So, you know, he's brought all that together for us. And what we try to do, and I try to do, is coach him in the areas that I think I can help.
Was that always the case, or has that changed over the years, the commercial sense that a driver now has to have, and I suppose the media skills as well? But I mean,
well, when you go back and think of the early days when we were racing, sponsorships $250, $300, and you think about these $200 or $300 million Formula One budgets, obviously we don't have quite that kind of a cost base in the U.S., but we've got to tie together. And for us, being in the integrated transportation services business, you know, we have a lot of B2B. You know, what tires do we use? What oil do we use? What fuel do we use? You know, what paint do we use? All of these things across our automotive business and also across our truck business. So, you know, we're very focused on tying these B2B things together, and there's no question this racing is the common thread through that.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the sort of loyalty of your team and the fact that you have this flat structure and people have stuck with the team for many, many years. How do you kind of promote that? I mean, if you could bottle it and sell it, that'd be something, right?
It's hard to sell, I think, and it's hard to build. Mm. And, you know, what we do is we have this, you know, very open, transparent organization. And as I say to people, I don't want to go to the final meeting when the decisions are made. I want to go to the pre-meeting where we can open discussion. And we try to have an open discussion with the key players in business on the race team, and including the drivers. And because if we're talking something we can't share with the people who are going to make it happen, we're making a big mistake. And I think it's a core value. I think you build it over time, and it gets infectious. And they know that my goal is that we need to be, we have really two customers, I say. It's the one inside you work next to each day, whether it's the engineering department, the build department, the engine guys. They got to connect. And then you got this partner outside, which is your commercial partner. But to me, I guess it's the DNA. My dad told me a long time ago that if you're only worrying about what you're going to get when you're working for a company, you're not going to get what you want. But if you support the company and the company's successful, then you're part of that. You're going to achieve results that you might never believe.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we've got a heck of a lot of reader questions that I want to get to in a moment. But whilst we're talking about your company, I wanted to talk a little bit about modern automotive industry, which obviously you are very, very much involved in. Is the win on Sunday, sell on Monday philosophy still valid, do you think? Do you find as a business?
Well, I think certainly I'm looking in the United States now that, you know, we represent Chevrolet at Indy. You know, we have Ford in the NASCAR side and the sports car side. We're involved with Acura. And I think what they try to do, the manufacturers, is link themselves with winners. And I think that's really what it is, because it helps support the brand. And in many cases, these are companies that have cars which are high performance. And racing goes with high performance. It goes with execution. It goes with teamwork. And I think the sell on Sunday, a race win on Sunday, and sell on Monday certainly is key, because you go to the NASCAR races and the Ford fans or the Chevy fans, you go to Australia, it's Holden, you know, versus Ford. And you certainly in Formula One, when you look at the different manufacturers, look what Ferrari's been able to do to build their brand on a worldwide basis. And you just see it. You can feel it when a Ferrari is in the neighborhood. So, you know, to me, there's a great connection with the auto industry. And I think that all of the CEOs in the auto industry seem to understand racing. And it gives them a chance, an outlet where they can really compete, maybe not in the boardroom or on Monday, but can compete on the track head to head under the same rules. And I think that's pretty important. And success there is certainly something that you know, means a lot to any manufacturer.
And how would you say your racing experience and your racing career has helped you in the boardroom?
In the boardroom?
Exactly.
Well, I think that... I'll talk tonight about the three pillars. I think I mentioned brand, technology, and people. You know, racing, that's all about racing, isn't it, when you think about it? If you're not checking those three boxes, you're not going to be successful. And I think that's the same thing that we've done with our company. and it was flat organization. And I would say 95% of the time we promote from within. We've got a diverse company. We want to see people outside the sport come in. And this be an entry-level job, no matter what it is in our car business or certainly in the truck business and in racing. And the racing side of it is just, to me, you know, it's not like your quarterly earnings that you have to give at Wall Street. We give quarterly earnings every single weekend, don't we, on Sunday? So we're used to the high and we're used to the low when you think about it. But, you know, overall, I think that... you know, the momentum and you know, my interest is to continue to achieve. And if I didn't have racing pushing me, because nobody gives you a lap ahead, do they? You win last week, you don't get a lap ahead of the field. So that's how I run my business, trying to get a lap ahead of the field.
Fantastic. The news this week that Donald Trump, the president of the United States, is thinking about imposing tariffs on imports, car imports. I know that you are very integrated currently and historically with European car makers and dealers. What's your opinion on that if it was to come to pass?
Well, I think there's two sides here. Maybe people don't realize that Sittner Group is a company that I bought from Frank Sittner, a racing guy. Think about how we got together, and he wanted to sell his business back in the early 2000s, and we bought Sittner. And you know, today, Sittner is now the number one auto retailer in the UK and Ireland. I don't know if you know that. We are the number one. We have almost 8,000 people. And it's a very interesting point with Brexit and the European Union, you know, what's going to happen there. But there's, I think, a pretty good balance between export-import if you look at the European Union and the UK now. Of course, with the manufacturers like Honda getting out, you know, obviously has another impact. But from a U.S. perspective, the German brands and the premium brands, we're about... 66% of our business in the U.S. is premium foreign, the Germans, quite honestly. And we see this Volkswagen situation has had a huge impact. It just trickled down in everybody's business. And if you put a $2,500 tariff, which is what people are talking about, whether it's true or false, it'll have an impact. And I'm not sure, we're not sure what it is, but we're bracing ourselves today. We have to expect that it could happen, and it's going to mean, you know, cutting costs. It could mean reducing a number of jobs within the company, dividend paying. All these things could be, you know, part of our menu of things to do. So it's troubling when we hear it, because the auto industry in the U.S., it's not just the manufacturers building the cars. It's a supply chain of people and companies around the world, really. Not everything's built in the U.S., and I think that's one of the issues. The U.S. manufacturers might be in great shape, but a lot of their content is coming offshore. So to me, it's certainly an issue that we talk about, and lately, almost every day, with people realize that the chamber have now given the president their thoughts on tariffs, and he has 90 days to make a decision. Now, he might do a tweet out tonight while we're here on what he wants to do, which could have impact, obviously, in the markets.
And do you think that, in a broader sense, could influence racing or could affect the motorsport scene in the States and indeed here?
I don't think so. I mean, if there's two cars, they're going to race, aren't they? So I don't see the umbrella of racing really being impacted by that. There might be some budgets that are cut because of manufacturers have to look at their cost base, and that's even happening today due to the sensation of autonomous, you know, and electric vehicles. So I wouldn't expect it to affect my race team.
Fantastic. Roger, we've been in we put out on social media for readers to ask you questions, and we were inundated with questions. Oh, wow. So I'm going to have to start asking some of them. It'll be fairly quick fire, I'm afraid, because we are running out of time. I'd like to start with Jordi Montaigne, who has asked, it'd be a pleasure and honour to have a question answered by Mr. Penske. So here goes. As a big Greg Moore fan, I'd like Mr. Penske to share his memories of him, whether it's one of the biggest what-ifs in racing.
Yeah, Greg, unfortunately, we had signed him up to drive our Indy car, and he was injured in the pit lane. early Sunday morning when a car hit him on his bike, and then went on to that race, you know, really with an arm probably it wasn't, a wrist that wasn't in great shape, and had the tragic accident. We felt he was going to be one of the superstars in the sport. We continue in contact with his family, and his dad still support our team, and it's a tragedy when you see that happen. So we really never had a chance to put him in the seat of a Penske car, but we knew that he was a future star.
And I have two that were sent to the Royal Automobile Club's Twitter. I'm going to just distill this quickly. Andy Halbury asked, how did you design, build the Beast, the Ilmor engine, and keep it secret all that time?
Well, that car's going to be on display. It's on display here tonight. You know, this was a challenge. You know, obviously, we had a Penske car, PC23. And we'd run Mercedes and other engines in that chassis. But the Buick used to come to the Indy, and they had 10 more inches of boost, so probably, what, 80, 90 more horsepower. And they'd sit on the pole, they'd lead 20 laps, then they'd blow up. So I got together with, you know, my partners, Mario Illion and Paul Morgan, who obviously have been very successful, as you know, a UK company, again, that tie-in with Penske Cars. And I said, let's build a pushrod engine. So I talked to Mercedes about that. Helmut Werner was the CEO at that point. He says, I'm in. So we started a design with a small group of people. We didn't talk about it at all in Reading for a while. And then we had a group of people. I put them in a separate building. And I told everybody, if we talk about this, you're going to be cutting off your paycheck, meaning it's a secret. We kept that secret. We didn't have chassis dynos in those days and other things. So we actually took the car to to Nazareth in the snow, cleared the track, and we're running our durability laps with Paul Tracy in a ski suit. So, and then we announced it, what, it was 2 weeks before the race, and everybody couldn't believe that we were running a pushrod. You know, we went on to win that race. I think we led every lap but two. And then they changed the car engine specs, reduced the power by half. And then a week later, they disallowed the category with a pushrod. So great history. Probably, I'd have to say, that was one of the greatest victories. Nobody knew we were coming. And to see the Norberg Haug and Zetcha and Jürgen Hubert and the team standing up there in the suite, seeing that Mercedes just blowing that off was, and seeing those guys in Team Penske shirts, our Penske Mercedes shirts, was for me something I'll never forget.
These are all the Mercedes, the big wigs from Mercedes.
Yeah, these are the top guys. Yeah, I mean, you know, yeah. The CEO and Hubert, the head of sales, and Norberg Hau, you might know that name. He was in charge of the racing business for a long time. It was a big day.
We've had a lot of questions about the Senna test in 92. How close were you to offering him a drive? Or was it a serious test?
Well, I think it was the relationship that Emerson Fittipaldi had, you know, with Ayrton Senna. And it was great to see him jump in the car and how quickly he adapted to it. But at that point, his Formula One and what we were doing, I think it was more to have him get a chance to drive it, to understand it. And maybe that was going to be a touch point for us the next year or the following year. So, you know, something like that you'd love to do. And the fact that Emerson and, you know, our relationship with Emerson and the team, our sponsors at Marlboro, it was a great, great opportunity.
And Gav asks here, who's your favorite British driver? Is it Dario Franchitti, who's here tonight, David Hobbs, John Watson, or Rob Gravett?
Well, look, all of those drivers are great friends of mine. So to pick one, I'm going to get the other three guys mad. But you'd have to say that the John Watson winning a Formula One race for us was pretty special. And the disappointment probably is that Franchitti, I knew him because of his Mercedes when he was running the sedans back early on in his career, became great friends. And he was a tremendous competitor of ours with Ganassi. On the other hand, I'm just going to take Watson because he won our only Formula One race. And that's the only reason.
I apologize for the curveball. Sorry. No.
Is it true that you asked him to shave his beard off?
I think he did shave it finally, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah.
He still is clean shaven.
Well, listen, it's interesting. You know, we kind of have this clean look, you know. We're like the choir boys that come to the track. But, I'm not a big guy on facial hair, quite honestly. Who knows? Maybe as I get older, I'll be more understanding.
I thought Ryan Blaney looked quite good with the whole.
Did you see him at Daytona on his own? You should have seen him this weekend. He looked pretty sharp.
Anthony Jenkins has asked, Mr. Penske, who coined the term the captain? And do you accept it as a term of respect or endearment?
Well, I think that I'm not sure where that started, whether Donahue called me the captain, but, you know, at the Hall of Fame induction in NASCAR a couple of weeks ago, you know, I've got 13 grandchildren, and they call me Mr. Fun because I don't babysit. I'm only having fun. So my son said he was going to introduce me that night as Mr. Fun. I said, look, I'm not going to be fun tonight. I'm going to be the captain. So, you know, it's a term people call me. Certainly, it's an honor for people to call me the captain because it looks like I'm managing something to have that that opportunity and name.
I've got another slight curveball here from Scott McLeod, who says, please could you tell us about your involvement in the America's Cup and the crossover in technology between motorsports and sailing? And I think this is a reference to the fact that your team principal of the one of the American Cup, America Cup's challenge boats.
Well, you know, I remember Dennis Conner back many years ago in America's Cup. I had happened to have the opportunity to go to Bermuda this last year and see the race. And you know, I was very interested to see whether, as an American, you know, I could play a part in bringing the cup back to the United States. And we were able to partner with the New York Yacht Club, which obviously is iconic. The first American Cup was won with a boat called American. The future boat was called Magic. So our boat call is called American Magic. And I think that we've got a very serious competitor, certainly here from the UK, people with great experience. But for me, It was another challenge. It is the America's Cup challenge, isn't it? Well, for me as an individual and a person, and to come together with two other key principals, Doug DeVos, you know, certainly, and Hap Fouth, who are great sailors, by the way. I'm a motor guy on the water, but I understand it. But the technology of aerodynamics, the build of these things, the carbon and all the things, it's just, you know, the foils and the foil arms and all these things. This is a brand new, when you think about it, it's a 75-foot hull with the ability to foil. You know, at speeds, probably these big boats will be over 50 knots. And to get up and see how these things operate. We have a mule that we have today that we've been testing with, and we'll build our main two boats coming up here in the next 12 to 18 months. But the technology, the communication, I had the five sailors at the Daytona 500 here this last weekend. And to see it, the only thing I didn't like was all the wrecks. I said, well, I'm not counting on you wrecking your sailboat. But it's a great honor. I'm very interested to see the technology. Again, it's a lot about rules. It's a lot about who wants this. Nothing different than the political movements back and forth that you see in all sites of racing. So we'll see.
It's incredible to see you still so excited about something very new, obviously.
Yeah, it's terrific. I was down on the chase boat here a week ago. I'm going back down next week again. But it's these guys, I mean, to see it. We were in 3 to 4 foot seas, and to see this thing get up and, you know, on plane and on the foil and start to foil with a rudder and one foil in the water, and you know, with speeds, you know, approaching almost 50 miles an hour is just amazing.
Question from somebody called Entropy. He asks, any drivers that you wished you had signed and missed out on?
Wow. Well, there's a lot of people. I would say that Scott Dixon, who is quite honestly really led the pack, you know, in IndyCar racing, was one New Zealander, a great friend of mine. I really am proud of what he's accomplished, both personally and, you know, and on the racetrack. Dario would have been someone that would have been great. But, you know, overall, Mario Andretti drove for us. We've had some great people. Maybe Foyt would have been some fun to have him drive for us at one point. But, you know, we are very satisfied. And when you look at the record, over 500 wins, and I think the number of drivers, we had the cream of the crop. And we were able to attract very good drivers, and they also delivered for us, so it was a win-win situation. You can't go back. You really got to look out the windshield and see where you're going, and I think our team going into 19 is we've got the best drivers we could have in all our series.
Well, sorry, when you say Scott Dixon, Juan Pablo Montoya narrowly missed out in 2015, and when was it that you thought, oh, Scott Dixon's the guy?
Well, Juan's already driving for us, so I was, you know, as a driver I didn't have. No, Juan has been a great driver, came with us, won the Indy 500. You know, it's amazing when you think about his success. He's a key guy on our sports car team now. So, you know, it's hard to say, and it kind of puts you in a tough spot there, especially when you have so many great people that have achieved success along with us.
Mm-hmm. That's a real couple.
And finally, Renato Garda writes to ask, he says that in the pre-race broadcast for the Daytona 500, you mentioned that the one trophy missing from your collection is the Le Mans trophy, Le Mans 24. If your team were to tackle this event, would it be in the prototype or GT class?
No, I think that we would love to go to Le Mans. I raced at Le Mans myself with a Ferrari with Rodriguez from Mexico many years ago. But you know, we would love to go there with a team. What we would do the year before we would run, we would go with certainly a GT car to understand the nuances of racing there and the rules and things. You can read it, you can see it, but you can't do what it's like being there every day or during the race. So we hope that these rules are sorted out and there'll be a point. They're talking about supercars now, things that maybe we can be able to afford a budget to go there. But it's certainly on my want list to get a victory there.
And you once approached Audi to run one of their LMP1s back in the day when they were...
Well, no, I think that we were with the Porsches at that point. You remember in LMP2, yeah. And we beat the Audis, and we, of course, had a great relationship there. But they had Yost and other teams that were, you know, really doing a great job for them. But I even said, hey, could we pull out one of these old Audis and maybe run one of those? But, you know, the diesel and all the iterations that have come since then, and certainly with the hybrid, you know, technology now, there's a lot to it. But it's a big step, and we have to be sure it doesn't impact our core racing business in the U.S. so and in Australia. So that's always going to be a question.
Okay. And finally, a question from me, really. You mentioned earlier about your son Jay and his involvement with Formula E. I'm just interested in your take on that. It's the racing is getting better. The crowd seem to be getting bigger. What's your view on Formula E and the move to electric?
Well, I think that Jay was one of the early adopters and, mm-hmm. you know, had two of the charters, you would call them. And I've seen him, grow with that. He's very enthused with it. I think the sport has been supported by the FIA, and there's a certain amount of interest as you go country to country to support an event in the city. Now, I think most of them are going back to similar tracks. There's some that have fallen off. But the interest, and what's really spun it up, I think, is the fact that you've got most, you know, the European OEMs now. In fact, I think almost all of them, the major ones, have a couple of cars. And I think that's always going to be key. They'll put capital in, they'll support the teams, and the technology will continue to grow. I'm glad to see now we have one car, not jumping from car to car, which yeah. I think makes yeah. makes a big difference. So I'm quite excited to see it, and of course my son Jay is an entrepreneur, and this is what he wants to do, and it's his team, and he's calling the shots, and I hope he's very successful, and I congratulate where the series has gone to date.
Great. I'm afraid, Roger, we are out of time. I'm being signaled at, but I'd like to thank you for your time and for your generosity in sharing all these memories that you've had of your extraordinary career. I hope that you enjoy the rest of your evening at the Royal Automobile Club and at the annual motoring dinner, and thank you again. That's the end of this Royal Automobile Club podcast. We'll be back in the coming months with more guests, and we hope that you will join us then. But for now, from me and from Sam, goodbye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.